Slava Zebranim Bhakta. Slava Shri Guru Shigarangi. We have a blackboard we can use. Om Agyana Timinandas Yaganam Jana Salakaya Chaksur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namo Vishnu Vidaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutai Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tiramane Namaste Saraswatim Deve Gauravani Vracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskyatya De Sitarane Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Hare Krishna. So the title of my seminars that I originally gave was Transforming Our Heart from Matter to Spirit. And I guess, I don't know if I put it, I guess I must have. Understanding our character conditioning, nature, needs, health issues. I couldn't have written so many things. Emotions from the point of Ayurveda and Jyotish, practical aspects, and spiritualizing them in Krishna consciousness. Anyhow, someone put it, maybe. So this is quite a challenge. Not so much as a challenge in order to present Ayurveda and Jyotish in a way that's understandable in terms of Krishna consciousness. I wrote my Vyas Puja offering this year on that basis. So this is going... Has anyone ever studied Ayurveda here before? Has anyone studied Jyotish? Well, this... It's going to be experience for me and everyone else. So here we go. All we need is a pen to write on the board. I also have to use my blood. That one might be very nice. In the meantime, it's actually goji berry here. Ayurveda, Jyotish, they're all following the Vedic tradition. Therefore, what they are essentially is language. The same thing is said in different ways, whether it's said in the Bhagavad Gita, or it's said in the Jyotish scriptures, or it's said by Ayurveda. It's the same thing, but in a different language. Generally, Ayurveda probably writes in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the story of Krishna and Balaram's education, when they went to Sandipani Muni's ashram, they learned, amongst other things, they learned Ayurveda and Jyotish. And Prabhupada writes in the purport that we have a school in Dallas and we have any children there. And just like previously in the Vedic culture, the Brahmins would go door to door. And so no family was bereft of either practical medicine or consultation with an astrologer. And just for a little donation, they get everything. A little bit, you know, give them a few chapatis and ask about their horoscope and some physical problem. So that was the Brahmin's job in the Vedic culture, go door to door, beg a little prasad, and give practical advice in Ayurveda and Jyotish. And then Prabhupada said every in another place, he said in our school in Dallas, these two things should be taught to the children. Now another place Prabhupada writes, Krishna Balarama and Gargamuni, because there are many examples of great devotees who are astrologers. Gargamuni, he gave the horoscope for Krishna Balaram. And he's quite accurate. No one could say that he was speculating. He said that Krishna would be called Giri Govardhan Dari because of lifting Govardhan Hill. Balaram would be called Sankarshan because he was able to attract two families together. He gave very accurate predictions. And Prabhupada said every gentleman should know about Jyotish. Because for people who don't have much faith in the Veda culture or have very little knowledge in the Veda culture, when you see how accurate Jyotish is, then the result is you develop some faith in the philosophy. Jyotish generally deals with the mundane aspect of the material experience. Although it does go up to a level, for instance, every planet is actually multidimensional. It can be looked at different angles. For instance, on the highest platform, who is the sun god? Or who is the sun amongst the avatars? Who? No, amongst the avatars. That means the sun, yes. So the sun is Lord Ramachandra. And who's the moon?
Krishna.
Krishna is. And who is Mars?
Nrsingadev.
So we got through the easy ones. Now who's next? Now we go to Mercury. Who's Mercury?
Buddha.
Buddha, yes. And who's Jupiter?
Vamanadev.
Yes, well, we have scholars here. And now we go to Venus. Who's Venus?
Parashuram.
Yes. You studied this before.
Yeah.
And who is Saturn?
Kurma.
Why is Saturn Kurma? Saturn does all the dirty work. Actually, that's Rahu does the dirty work. But who's Rahu? Varahadev. And Ketu?
Matsya.
Yes. So actually, Kormadev. And so these are on the highest level, the different planets. And amongst the demigods, we have the sun god, we have the moon god, we have Mercury, who is Buddha. And then we have Mars, who is Kartikeya. And then we have amongst the demigods, Venus is Sukracharya. And Rahu is Rahu. Ketu is Ketu. And Saturn is Saturn. But we can get down to the most elementary part of existence, which is the elements. So when we talk about elements, ultimately what we're talking about when we talk about elements, we're talking about qualities. Sometimes people think it's rather primitive when we talk about the elements, like earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego. And Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita, as you know. So it seems rather primitive, you know, a clod of earth, and then there is some water and whatever, rather than the 108 or 10 elementary elements that they have found. But actually, language is just a summary always of experience. It never really represents completely experience, unless you're transcendental, you're using transcendental language. But this language of earth, water, fire, and air, and ether is simply a summary of experience. So as we know, earth means everything that's solid, that appears to be solid, although nothing is really solid. it just appears to be relatively more solid than other things. For instance, the floor that we're standing on, I may kick my heel into the floor, but it's relatively more solid. So unless I have a very strong heel, a lot of force, nothing really happens. Although something does happen, it'll make a sound which indicates that there's ether. At least there's ether. And then what holds everything together is the water element. Or water is the all the existence that tends to cause cohesion. For instance, if you have dough, if you have flour, we have a board, but we don't have pens. Oh, we have two pens. So actually, I'm going to start with, go the other way around. We're going to go ether, and then from ether, what's the next element down?
Air.
And then?
Fire.
And then? And then? And then above this we have the subtle energies, which is the moon. And above that, the whole thing is the soul, the sun. What is everything supposed to be a revolve around? The soul, the sun. So these are what the material nature is made out of. But this is just a summary. So everything that ether is has the quality of being able to hold things within them. Everything is accomplished within the ether. And then we have the air, which is the quality of movement. Everything that's moving is moving because of air. So air can be many varieties. It's not just one. Sometimes they call it oxygen. Sometimes they call it hydrogen. Sometimes they call it so many different names. Helium. But it's all considered air because it moves things. Actually, these things are a transformation. Because when there's a lot of space, and from the space, air, by a transformation, air appears. And then when air, for instance, air due to friction, when air rubs things together, then it causes fire. And then the fire, from the fire manifests water. And then from water, when water cohesives, then it becomes earth. So these are just transformations from subtle to gross. So similarly, from ether, there are different planets that represent ether in this universe. So what's the planet that represents ether in the universe? What's that? Planet. Jupiter. So in Jyotish, Jupiter is a quality of philosophy, brihaspati, knowledge, etc., the goal of life, understanding what the goal of life is, and brahminical planet has many different qualities, but generally it's the ether is that space that holds everything. So philosophy, our view of life holds everything within it. Yes? According to how big our philosophy is, our vision of life, our goal, that's going to determine everything else. If my goal in life is just to make money and enjoy my senses, then obviously my goal of life is going to be rather restricted. My activities are going to be restricted to that. If my goal of life is actually to go back to the spiritual world, then my activities are going to be very much different. Just to go over quickly, air is our activities, fire is our determination to perform those activities, water is the comfort we get from that activity, And earth is what the practical result of the activity. The practical activity is what the results are. Solid activity. And when the activity is good, if our goal actually produces practical results, then we become encouraged, and that modifies our goal. Just like, for instance, if my goal of life is to make $1 million, practical activity. So my goal of life, and therefore I have to figure out some way of making it. I can't do everything to make $1 million. I have to figure out some methodology of doing it. I have to restrict it. So restriction is Saturn. Saturn is working in time, and time always makes restriction. Saturn is that planet which is furthest out and is a restrictive planet. So now I have to narrow down my activities. I have a big goal, but now I have to narrow it down how to actually get what I'm looking for. So that's Saturn. But I may have a big goal, like for instance, make $1 million. Now I've decided to work in the stock market. So I've narrowed my goal down, or my activity down to working practically and doing something. So after doing that, then in order to do it every day, I need some fire. I need some determination. So that's Mars. I have to overcome obstacles. Generally speaking, we just don't put our hands up and then the demigods just throw the money down. We have to work. We have to figure out what to do. And then we have to go through sometimes some austerity, overcome obstacles, and that's Mars. Fire. Unless someone has some fire, they can't really do anything in a long run. Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Saraswati Prabhupāda said, unless you have life, you can't preach. So fire and life, fire gives a life. Without fire, we can't digest food. We can't see anything without fire in the body. We have to digest. We have to digest obstacles. We have to digest opportunities. Just like when we look, we see vibrations. Actually, what we're seeing is just vibrations coming to our eyes, and then our eyes, our brain digests those vibrations, and it comes out as sight. We put food in the stomach, then it digests it, and it comes out as this body that we have now. It's transformed by fire. And then after fire, we have that determination. But what is our goal? How can we tell if it's actually good or not? There has to be some kind of comfort, which is Venus. We want something to come out nicely. We just don't want to work and create problems for ourselves. We want to work and create comfort. We want to create something which is favorable, which is pleasing and satisfying. Because nowadays, due to the fact that we're living in a materialistic civilization, they only have, out of the four goals of life, there's Dharma, there's Artha, there's Kama, and there's Moksha. But unfortunately, nowadays there's no Dharma and there's no Moksha, there's only Artha and Kama. And therefore people, they don't know how to properly satisfy their senses. They don't know how to economically develop to satisfy their senses. So here in these two middle ones, fire and water, fire is Mars, if you look at this. And Venus is, yes? So does that look familiar? So what is Mars? What does that symbol mean? Masculine. And Venus is feminine. So this is an important juncture. Fire and water. Water can put out fire, and fire can put out water. they have to be properly balanced. Fire and water are, when they combine together in the body, they're called pitta. And ether and air are called vata, when they're in balance. And water and earth are kapha. So now we have water, comfort, just like receptive. Fire is masculine, it burns, and water is supposed to be receptive. And then we have earth, which is represented by mercury. Mercury is a combination of all the different elements. Because that's where earth is. So it's the visible manifestations that we see. Vedic philosophy is quite intricate. Earth has all the different qualities of all the other elements. So within, for instance, this microphone, this sound, we can hear it. And there's also solid, and it's held together because of the water in it. Of course, I wouldn't drink the microphone. But there is water in here. There's something liquid that holds it together. And then there is also fire, because it's not completely cold. There was no fire, we could hold it. It would be freezing cold. And then there's also air. And then there's also ether. So all these elements are within earth. So mercury is a physical manifest, was what we can see as a result. So if I, for instance, in the analogy I use, I have a goal to get millions of dollars. I narrow it down to working in the stock market. I go there every day with great determination and intelligence, and I try to make some money. I actually learn how to do it very expertly after some time. With less effort, I start making more money. And the result, I have money. And I utilize it to buy property. And then I become even more inspired. So these elements are what Manas Society is working on. But there are two other planets. There's actually four other planets. There's Rahu. And then there's Ketu. Jupiter looks like, I'm not an expert at drawing. This is Jupiter, this is Saturn, this is Venus, Mars, Mercury looks like this. They're actually very significant because the Sun is like this and the Moon is. So the Sun represents the soul. The soul, the consciousness of the soul. Of course, nothing material represents the soul, but the consciousness. And when the consciousness is here, when the soul is in a material body, he has his reflection of that consciousness. It's called the mind. So the mind, what is the mind? What is the goal of the mind, actually? What do we actually feel? What do we want? Does anyone know what we really want in the material world? So we want enjoyment happiness. What is Krishna saying in the Bhagavad Gita about what's the preliminary qualification for happiness and enjoyment? Peace. Peace, yes. So everyone is actually looking for peace. What is nashti buddhya yuktasya na cha yuktasya bhavanaha na cha bhavyantakam shantir ashantasya kutak sukham. For one who's not in divine or Krishna consciousness, they can have neither a controlled mind nor steady intelligence, without which there's no possibility of peace, and how can there be any possibility of happiness without peace? So unless we're peaceful, how can we be happy? Unless we realize that we're eternal, how can we be peaceful? Is that right? If I identify myself with this body, What's the possibility of being peaceful? We can take intoxication. We can do so many things and try to forget that we're about to leave our body. But still, we, in the back of our minds, we feel unprotected. A little insect can come here, bite us, and we're done for the day or the year or this life. So that's possible. Therefore, everyone feels unprotected in the material world because the soul, who's eternal, his consciousness, has been reflected into a false identification. The mind's false ego causes us to identify ourselves with the body, and therefore we feel unprotected, not peaceful. And therefore, we go through a process of existence in the material world based upon these different energies in the material world. One of the energies is energies represented by the planets, or summarized by the planets, and their particular circumstances that they find themselves, or that are found at the time of our appearance. And that governs our manifestation, current manifestation, this body, and the particular mind that we took along with us, actually according to the mind that we took along with us from our last lifetime, the demigods manifested a particular body according to their particular situation. I don't know if you understood that. It's pretty complicated. But our minds carried us, the soul due to his desires, because that's the sun, due to his desires, his attachments and aversions that he acquired for different lifetimes, created this mind, or the material nature created or molded a mind for him, and that mind took him, perfectly arranged by the demigods, into a particular body, and the demigods, according to their particular situation at that time, gave them a particular body, at the time of birth at least. It's also, one can also do a horoscope for the time of conception too, which is also just as relevant. Do a horoscope right now and find out what our relationship with the demigods are. Or the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his different incarnations, depending upon what we're interested in. So what is this? And then we have Rahu and Ketu. Rahu is why we've taken birth here, what our principal reason, what our insatiable desire, our main interest, we could say, what we really wanted to accomplish in this lifetime, what we felt unfulfilled about in our last lifetime. There was something that we felt that we needed to do, that we felt unfulfilled about, and that's shown by Rahu. And what we worked on very hard in many previous lifetimes, that's shown by Ketu. So whatever we worked hard, developed the talent, it just didn't satisfy us because nothing is satisfying in the material world. Doesn't matter how expert you can become. When I grew up, one of the things I studied a lot of things always. One of the things I studied was chess. That I studied like 4 hours a day. I used to be captain of my chess team. And my main chess. And one of my main heroes at that time was Bobby Fischer. So he was the champion of the world, and then he never played again after he became the world champion. And I never saw the interview, but I saw on YouTube he had an interview, and the name of the interview is Chess is Boring. See, we can't imagine how many lifetimes he probably studied this particular game, or sometimes they call it a sport in Russia. But you become so expert at something, it becomes boring. Because you think, oh, if I just become so expert, I'm going to get so much pleasure. And you become completely expert in that field, and there is no bliss in it at all. You're just expert. It gets boring because you defeat everyone except for the material nature, who ultimately kills you, defeats you. Paravas tavada bodha jata yavana jignasita atvatadvam. Ultimately, everyone is being defeated by ignorance, although we think we're defeating others. So Ketu is what we become expert at. That we really focus in maybe one lifetime, maybe many lifetimes. So we're looking for peace, actually, and we're looking at, well, maybe it's here. No, it's not there. So then we decide we're going to go to the opposite, completely the opposite, and we become things that we're very unfamiliar with, generally speaking, new charted land, let me explore that and balance out the other side of myself. And maybe then I'll find bliss in that balance. Just like male and female, the balance of the energies. So the material world, we're always trying to balance, find some balance here, where we feel some stability, where we don't feel we're being swayed, just like you're on a boat on the water, and then the boat's going this way, and then you want it to go that way, and you're getting seasick, because it's rocking back and forth. So that's material nature. One lifetime we're male, then we become attracted to the female energy, and then we're a female, we become attracted to the male energy, because we're looking for that balance. So, the balance between fire and water, so we can digest the material experience, and maybe eventually come to the platform of peace of mind. That we can find out what is the goal of life, how to work for that goal of life, how to narrow it down to a practical work for according to my psychophysical nature, what my capacity to do something is, what I could practically do in this world, and when work, and do it with determination. Just like I know I should be chanting japa, and do it without offense. That's Jupiter. We hear so much philosophy about it, so much knowledge about it. We have that as a goal to chant Hare Krishna, so that my mind can be absorbed in Krishna consciousness. And so my soul can actually meet Krishna again. My conscious, I'll become Krishna conscious. If my mind is somewhere else, then there's no possibility of manifesting consciousness of Krishna. So let my mind be dwelling on Krishna. Let it be absorbed, the name, form, quality, and pastimes of Krishna, so that I can experience it with my consciousness. I can experience Krishna. So that's my goal. That's Jupiter. Big goal. And therefore, practically doing it, I chant japa every day. But my mind is wandering. It's not so obedient. Therefore, I need determination to do it every day. I need that fire, and that enthusiasm to do it. Or else some obstacle comes along and I deviate. And then it should become blissful. It should be some pleasure, some awareness, some knowledge of how to do it better should come. Otherwise, if every day, just like in the beginning of the movement, the devotees used to chant japa and they'd fall asleep. And so you see devotees in the temple, you know, against the wall, Hare Krishna, Krishna, trying to keep themselves awake, knocking their head against the wall. Or other times we find the devotees, they were listening to class, and the temple commander would come with a squirt gun and squirt the devotees who were falling asleep. Because it has to become pleasurable, otherwise we won't really, it has to become, at least we have to see some progress that is becoming easier, I'm becoming more expert. So that's Venus. I'm actually I'm digesting the experience, and it's actually getting some nutrients. So Venus is also in charge of the nutrients in the body, the digestion in the body, the nutrients we get out of what we eat. It's not so much what we eat, but what we actually get out of it. Mars will show us what we can digest, and Venus will show us the nutrients we get out of it. This class could go on for 3 months. It's quite amazing sciences, Jyotish and Ayurveda, in terms of Krishna consciousness. Because just fire, there's four kinds of fire. There's Sama Agni, which is when the fire digestion is going properly. There's not too much fire, there's not too much water or air. it's just going properly. When there's too much air, it's called Vishama Agni. Very, just like air is very irregular. So, Vishama Agni, one day I'm constipated, and one day I have diarrhea. One day I'm hungry, next day I can't eat for a couple of days. So that's called Vishama Agni. How do you know when it's time to eat? Does anyone know? When you're hungry. Not everyone knew that one. So, Vishama Agni, then we have Tiksha Agni. The fire is so strong, I eat the food, and there's nothing left. It just burns everything to ashes. And so I eat a big meal. 2 hours later, I have to have another big meal because I'm starving to death. Because my fire is so strong. No nutrients. When there is Vishama Agni, then we're not getting any nutrients because sometimes the fire is too much, sometimes too little. Therefore, we're not really digesting our food. Tiksha Agni, we're burning everything. There's no toxins, but there's nothing. There's just burnt food. And then we have Manda Agni, slow Agni. I eat something and 3 weeks later I'm hungry again. So those don't really produce nutrients. So Mercury, in one sense, is in charge of digestion of Venus because the nutrients, what we're actually getting out of what we're doing, the actual substance, the energy that's actually nourishing us, we need some nourishment or else we can't go on. No matter how determined we are, Saturn, to do the activity, no matter how much we've defined it and determined to do it, no matter how much enthusiasm we have for it, if we don't get some nutrients out of it, we can't go on doing it. And then it has to manifest itself in some kind of practical result. We should actually have something to show for it. Prabhupada said in our society, how many books we're distributing, how many people, devotees are joining the movement, how much property we're getting from the deities. It can't just be all up in the clouds somewhere. Something practical should come from it. Or at least, practically, I should become purified. I should develop good qualities. That's the most practical thing. My activity should be more and more devotional. And when that manifests, then I become encouraged. Yes, I'm making progress. The philosophy is real. Let me study the philosophy, get more deeply involved, how to modify my activities, how to become more enthusiastic and determined, how to actually get more nutrients, more love for Krishna. Notice Venus, it represents love also in the material world. And Mars represents protection, support, etc. So these things are just manifestations of the original, well, they're just Krishna's energies, either they're material or spiritual, but ultimately it's the same energies working. The only difference is one is for Krishna, and one is for our sense gratification. One has dharma, with the idea of ultimately moksha, which is peace of mind and liberation of the soul. And the other one simply is revolving around artha and kama. Artha, getting things in the material world, and kama, enjoying the material energy. So, when these are balanced, then when everything is balanced and flows towards liberation of the mind becomes purified and the soul becomes liberated from misconceptions, then the soul makes some progress. And when no one knows about the soul, no one knows about how the mind works, you know, no one really knows, you know, what the actual goal of life is, or how to achieve it, or how to get the determination to do it, and how to ultimately get substance for the soul out of material existence so that the soul can actually do something practical for his own liberation, then unless this knowledge is there, there's no progress, either for ourselves or anyone else. I'm supposed to stop, I guess. Is that right? What time? See, I started at 12:30 and it goes to a quarter. No, that's right. We're just beginning. Yeah, it's supposed to go to 12:45. So I'll stop there for right now. I'm supposed to go to 1:45. So any questions about this? We had that example of the iceberg and the tip of the iceberg. Well, this is the tip of the tip of the iceberg. Yes. Mercury is the actual practical result. Venus is nutrients. But why do we want nutrients? We want nutrients because we want to do something with them. If we feel satisfied, for instance, in our Krishna consciousness, then what do we want to do? We want to go out and spread Krishna consciousness to others. If you never get any satisfaction from chanting Hare Krishna, then why would you bother telling other people to do it too? If we don't read Prabhupada's books, then why would we want to distribute them ultimately? We don't know what's in them. So we get nutrients from them, we get something back from them, we get some inspiration, we get some satisfaction, then we want to give them to others. If I'm actually satisfied with what I'm doing, then by acting in Krishna consciousness, then I can develop good qualities. If I'm dissatisfied with what I'm doing, then I'll be looking for something else to do. And the good qualities won't manifest themselves. Freedom from lust, anger, and greed won't come if I'm not satisfied with what I'm getting back from chanting Hare Krishna. If I'm not feeling love for Krishna, which is Venus, then why will I want to keep on chanting? Or why will I want to do what's necessary to develop the good qualities and do what's necessary practically to become Krishna conscious? Why will I use my energies, invest them into Krishna consciousness unless I'm getting some satisfaction from what I'm doing? If my philosophy doesn't reflect in activities and determination that gives me satisfaction in Krishna consciousness, then I'll seek satisfaction in something else. Is that clear? Anything? Yes.
Hare Krishna. I have one question. Can it be seen from the chart that you have some predispositions to start with Bhakti Yoga, or that you have done that previously?
Yeah, of course. You can see everything from the chart. You can see if you're an avatar or not. Which is very unlikely that any of us are avatars. If you can see, like for instance, Gargamuni looked at Krishna's astrological chart and decided that he was God. And he could look at our chart and he'd figure out we probably aren't God. Similarly, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, even before he was born, Nilambar Chakravati, he understood exactly when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would make his appearance by looking in the future at the possibilities of the astrological charts. Yeah, so you can see everything but this will just show us what we've come into the material world with. Now, if you look at a chart and you find out there are certain planets and aspects and situations that will probably show what the person's interest is. Matter of fact, there are what the people are interested. Exactly whether they're going to become a devotee or not, or what kind of devotee, that can also be told, but it takes a lot of expertise. But everything can be, if you're expert enough, you can tell everything from the astrological chart. But you have, who's that expert? I mean, the Prabhupada writes that the Jataka Brahmins, when they saw Pariksit Maharaj's birth chart, they understood that. They told King Yudhisthira everything about him. How he'd rule, how he'd defeat Kali, and how a snake bird would come at a certain time and bite him, and he'd have to leave his body and go back to the spiritual world. And Yudhisthira Maharaj was very happy when he heard about the predictions of Jatakas, and they all came out. Now, how this works in terms of our lives, yes, you could probably look at your astrological chart and see what the situation was when you took birth, if you have the proper, the right time, and you have the right, everything is proper. There's so, I mean, so, such a complicated, but generally speaking, you can understand. And then you can see where you're probably interested in. So Prabhupada wanted, for instance, at Gita Nagari, I'm going to sit down for a second. He wrote an essay on Gita Nagari, if anyone has read that. It was in 1955, I think, before he came. And there, Srila Prabhupada said that in order to determine the varna of the children, we should examine their astrological charts. Another place, I mean, Prabhupada even, there was one devotee, Subhadra, I think her name was, 1967, when Prabhupada was in India, Subhadra asked him about her daughter, if Prabhupada could get an astrological chart done in India for her. And Prabhupada said, yes, I'll do that. Prabhupada said, misuse of a great science. This is in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam in relationship to that particular aspect of Pariksha Maharaj taking birth. He said, misuse of a great science doesn't make it useless. So this science could be misused, and it could be utilized in Krishna consciousness too. But everything is there. It's whether we want to spend, someone has a propensity or wants to spend their life learning it, that would be alright. But someone would have to have that propensity and ability to learn it. Otherwise, it's not really valuable for everyone to learn. It's quite a complicated science. And generally speaking, there are not such expert teachers in this particular science. Although the knowledge is quite, at least to me, it's fascinating. And it is helpful. I mean, sometimes the devotees, they do sinistry, the readings for marriage. So it's also valuable. It's even more valuable if the devotees are taught how to take it seriously. Because generally speaking, devotees go and they want to find out. They have a relationship. And then after they quote, fall in love with each other, then they want to go and have their astrological charts compared to make sure that, you know, they're compatible. And if the astrologer says they're not compatible, then they go to another astrologer. Until they find one that agrees that this match is very good. Just like one devotee, she was living with another devotee for, I think it was like 12 years. And they had two children, and they decided to get married. So she went to her mother and told her mother that they're going to get married. And her mother said, well, be very careful. Make sure he's the right man. Yes.
I've heard that if you're married with someone for 3 years, it looks in the chart like they're already married.
I'm sure it's less than 3 years, but yeah, the relationships are there, you know, within the chart. And also there are, yeah, everything is there. I mean, when you look at the Vedic culture, the way they had marriages, they didn't sign a piece of paper, and they didn't, you know, have it legally registered at the city hall. It was agreed when the two man and woman got together, when they had the blessings of their superiors, and they had a ceremony in front of the fire and Vishnu, or whoever else they were worshiping, then it was considered a marriage. Nowadays, our relationships are so distorted and so weak, we have to have all the state come down and make sure they stay together, because most people make a promise and they have their fingers crossed. Not only marriage, but everything else. Yes, I'll follow four of the principles for at least 2 weeks. as long as I'm inspired. So we make promises, but we're very... Prabhupada was amazed how, especially in the Western world, how flippant people are. Of course, nowadays India is not that much different. How they make promises and they don't really take it very seriously. So they have to have all these legal arrangements so that the person, when they have their children, the children are not out in the street. But nowadays, even those aren't sufficient. Because a lot of children are in the streets in some parts of the world. But in the Vedic culture, it was easy. I mean, there was a relationship form and people had some responsibility. So marriage is not simply a question of legally getting married. There's also, there are other factors like taking responsibility, understanding what the purpose of marriage is, etc., etc. That's what keeps the marriage together. I don't know if that answers your question, but because when I grew up, for instance, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. And during that time, no one ever got divorced. I mean, there were some rumors of someone in the neighborhood somewhere, their parents were divorced, but no one got divorced. It was just unheard of. Then I remember distributing books at the airport. I meet all these ladies with children, and I said, you know, oh, very nice child. You know, where is your husband? She said, I don't have a husband. Like, you know, how dare you ask me if I have, we don't have husbands. Really, where did the key child come from? I don't know. So that's the present society. There's no, it's not that they don't have laws. They have so many laws, but they're not teaching anyone what the goal of life is. They're not teaching anyone how to take responsibility. The real essential things of life. They're only teaching somehow or another, make money. Because certain people, they just print it up. Everyone else has to work for it. So, there are certain unfortunate people who have to work to get the piece of paper. And other people have a printing press. They just print it up. They get as much as they want. And they have everyone else working for the piece of paper. So make money. And then spend it for something that they consider sense gratification. But in modern society, people don't even know what sense gratification is. They think sense gratification is to eat something unlimitedly. Whatever it is. Kentucky Fried Chicken. If they can eat that unlimitedly, then that's, you know, they're in bliss. I can eat as much as my belly gets bigger and bigger, and therefore I'm expanding. I'm making progress. Or I have more and more sex life with anything and anyone, male, female, alive, dead, you know, I'm really enjoying it. So people are just, they have no idea what sense gratification is. They have no idea even what gross sense gratification is. They don't know what to eat. They don't know how to sleep. They don't know what a relationship is, how to even mate. And they have no idea how to defend themselves in any aspect whatsoever from other people's anger or greed or lust, other vibrations coming from the outside. They don't even know how to defend their own body, how to eat properly. They don't know how to live properly. They don't know anything. The only thing that's developed in modern society is people's false ego. Everything else is degraded. They actually think they're the greatest civilization that ever lived. And they're practically the lowest civilization that's existed so far. And that includes relationships. You can look at the seventh house, but relationships are not just the seventh house in astrology. There's the fourth house, your mind, your house, what you're taking shelter of, what you consider comfortable. The second house, what you eat. What you say, what your relationships with others are, your beginning education in your life, how your mother and father related to each other. This, all the houses, your dharma, your ninth house, all those have to be seen in terms of any kind of relationship. And if people are weak in those things, then they can't keep a relationship with any one person for very long, with anyone. They have no peace of mind in the family. They have no security or protection. They don't know how to talk nicely to each other and establish a relationship. They don't know what to eat. They don't know how their food is influencing their consciousness. They had no good family upbringing. They have no education and how to live in a family. They have no ancestry, practically speaking. Maybe they did descend from the apes. And they have no purpose of life other than to gratify their senses. So they have no determination. They don't know what to do. All those things are in the astrological chart. The problem is people aren't trained at all, that there's something other than gratifying the senses. So even the devotees, they get together because of love. Love, let me see what you taste like. Yes, I'll let you bite me, and I'll bite you, and we can live happily ever after, biting each other, until I lose my taste for you, and I look for someone else to bite on. And then we have divorce, and this scandal, and, you know, Krishna consciousness marriage doesn't work. Well, first of all, it's not even marriage. It's not even proper marriage. What to speak of done in Krishna consciousness? It just, it's our misconception. What is marriage and what is Krishna consciousness? And how to develop marriage properly and how to develop Krishna consciousness. And how to even develop our health. Because that's what we're supposed to be doing. Also hear Ayurveda. And how to transform our heart from matter to spirit. The Veda culture is more or less, for instance, since we're on the subject of marriage, in the Veda culture, people learn to love each other, not because they gratify each other's senses unlimitedly, but because they actually learn to love Krishna, they learn to become spiritual, they come to the mode of goodness. The man is supposed to have the qualities of goodness, and he's supposed to help, the lady may have more of the qualities of goodness. They're supposed to help their spouse develop the qualities of goodness, and in the qualities of goodness, they learn to love each other. They actually have affection for each other, because the soul naturally has affection. When he's in Krishna consciousness, beginning with the mode of goodness, when he's more conscious, then actually he feels more satisfied. And when you're satisfied, then the service relationship develops. Then there's actually an exchange based upon a real affection, not simply sense gratification. So duty will actually lead to Krishna consciousness, which will lead to ultimately the awakening of actual love for everyone, including one's family. And if one doesn't love Krishna, if he's not developing his relation with everyone else, especially in this age, it's very unlikely he'll actually love his family or even be dutiful to his family. What to speak of actually loving them? Generally in the Vedic culture, people took satisfaction by doing their duty. There's a kind of happiness from the mode of goodness. Freedom, happiness in the material world means freedom from anger and lust, which leads to envy and madness, and all kinds of other negative things. So when we're free from those, then we get peace. We get peace of mind, which is a kind of satisfaction, a liberation from material anxiety. So that's the happiness that's maximum in family life in the material world, satisfaction by doing one's duty. And that will eventually, ultimately lead, hopefully, to Krishna consciousness. It's further developed, and then one loves everyone, including one's family members. Although, just like Vyasadeva and Shukadeva Goswami, as I said the other day, Shukadeva Goswami was naked when he was born, as most people are, except for Vishnu. So he left the womb, he was 16 years old, his mother was quite relieved. And he walked out, and he was walking by, just wandering, and he walked by some naked ladies who were bathing. But they didn't cover themselves because they understood that he was innocent. He was in Brahman realization. He didn't really differentiate between men and man and woman. He could see that there's a woman's body and a man's body, but because he had no lust or anger or greed, He saw actually the soul as the most important thing, and the body is just a dress made out of the material nature. But when Vyasadeva passed by looking for his son, the ladies covered themselves. So Vyasadeva was certainly on the same level as Shukadeva Goswami, so he was a little surprised. Why is, when my son passed, you didn't cover yourselves, but now I'm going by and you're covering yourselves? So they said that, my dear Vyasadeva, you're a householder. So you're supposed to differentiate between a male and a female, otherwise how can you be a householder? But your son's a liberated soul. You're liberated also, but you're taking the position of a householder. So even a liberated soul, he may act in a certain way towards his family, but still, if he's liberated, he'll actually love his family on the same levels, you know, as he loves everyone else in Krishna consciousness. So that's real love. As Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura said, I came into my house and the Charanamrita, I entered into Goloka Vrindavan. I took the Charanamrita and it turned into the River Ganges. So that's spiritual vision. Anything else? Yes. Yes.
What is the importance of giving child name according to astrology?
Well, this is rather a complicated question, but to answer it simply, according to the astrological chart, the child is named after the nakshatra that the moon is in, the time of birth. So the moon is the planet of growth. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that I enter into the moon, and by the juice of the moon, everything is, all the juice of the plants, of the vegetables becomes manifested. So the moon is what grows things. So in order to be in harmony with the moon's vibration at the time of birth, one may give a name which is in harmony with that moon vibration. But higher than that, we could also give the name according to, you know, Krishna's names, which the moon is subordinate to, those vibrations. Krishna's name surpasses everything. But to name him John or Judy is not very auspicious. Nothing's going to happen. On the basis of hearing that name is not going to grow anything, except for lose your energy. By the way, what we're trying to grow, ultimately the real fruit or the real result should be peace of mind. So we go from Shudra, trying to regulate their sense gratification, to Vaishya, growing the things necessary and protecting the animals so that sense gratification is provided for the society, real economic development. And then finally we get to the Kshatriyas, which should protect the society so outside influence doesn't enter. And then we have the Brahmins leading to the path of liberation and actual peace of mind. So what's ultimately being grown by the society is the peace of mind that we're looking for and ultimately liberation. Sometimes we hear it growing. Sometimes we think it means to like manifest factories and, you know, that kind of growth is not really great. The real ultimate growth is the peace that comes from understanding that we're eternal servants of Krishna. That's the ultimate fruit of everything. Transcendental knowledge. So unless the mind is peaceful, unless our activities are centered around Krishna, then the receptivity to transcendental knowledge will be there, and so the soul doesn't actually realize his eternal relation with Krishna.
Yes. Kada onaj kvalifikovani astrolog posjetio Sri Chaitanju Mahaprabhuva, on je prvo napravio astrološki proračun i onda je zaronio u duboku meditaciju.
Well, before this famous astrolog came to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu,
on je napravio astrološki proračun
I onda je zaronio u duboku meditaciju.
Then he make his chant and then he go into deep meditation.
Well, that's the many Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had. That was when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was going around Navadvip trying to get donations or getting donations from different persons, different people who were selling things or vendors. So he came to one astrologer and he asked the astrologer, who was I in my last lifetime? So the astrologer, Prabhupada said he was very expert. He didn't have to write out an astrological chart. He simply meditated. So he meditated, and the first thing he saw was this fish swimming in the ocean. This huge fish. Then he saw this tortoise. Then he saw this boar. And he said, I'm having a very bad day. I can't really figure it out. Maybe you can come back later. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, no, try again. I think you're doing all right. Just try once more. So he went into meditation and he saw this man with his axe killing people. Blood everywhere. And then he saw this man with a bow and some monkeys and he's thinking, I'm getting closer. And then he said, I know who you are. In your last lifetime, you were the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, no, you don't understand. He said, I know who I was in my last lifetime. In my last lifetime, I was a cowherd boy. And because of my pious activity of herding the cows, in this lifetime I was born as a Brahmin. Anything else? All right, so we'll stop there. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaur Premanande Haribol.